goes on to say that a few kilometers away in Israel, all the vulnerable groups have been vaccinated, and they are planning to move on to vaccinating healthy adults and youths who are less vulnerable, especially to severe complications. Here in the West Bank, there are around 10,000 doses, which is enough for 5,000 people to be vaccinated. In the hospital where I work, staff have been offered the vaccine, but the available doses do not come close to covering the healthcare workers, let alone the elderly and people with medical conditions that make them susceptible to dying of COVID-19. The United States Senator and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders wrote a joint letter with other senators urging Secretary of State Blinken to pressure Israel to vaccinate Palestinians. In the letter, it states that, quote, while the Oslo Accords give the Palestinian Authority considerable responsibility for the health care of Palestinians, the Accords do not supersede Israel's responsibilities under the Fourth Geneva Convention. And this is absolutely correct. Because you see, this is what the Israelis are trying to argue. They're claiming that they have no legal obligation to vaccinate Palestinians, despite the fact that they're illegally occupying Palestinians. The Israelis claim that under the Oslo Accords of 1995, if you look at Annex 3, Article 17, it says, quote, powers and responsibilities in the sphere of health in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip will be transferred to the Palestinian side, including the health insurance system. However, under Article 56 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, it says that, quote, the occupying power, which is Israel in this case, has the duty of ensuring and maintaining, with the cooperation of national and local authorities, the medical and hospital establishments and services, public health and hygiene in the occupied territory, with particular reference to the adoption and application of the prophylactic and preventative measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. It's important to note, however, that the Oslo Accords, they were a bilateral agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians. The Geneva Convention is much larger than that, much older than that. It's a pillar of international law. So it's completely irrational and unreasonable to argue that the Oslo Accords somehow cancel out or supersede the Geneva Convention, which Israel and Palestine are both a party to. Also, even if you want to take the Israelis' argument at face value, how can you expect the Palestinians to be in charge of their own health affairs when Israel is occupying them? How are Palestinians expected to run an efficient healthcare system and build public health infrastructure when they are told what they can and can't import, when they are told when and where they can go, when they don't even have a state, when they are living under a brutal Zionist occupation that denies them their basic human rights? And if the occupation wasn't bad enough, every single time Israel viciously bombs Gaza, it purposely targets civilian and public health infrastructure. And while Mr. Erdan, who is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, claims on Twitter that the Palestinian Authority is responsible for its own health affairs and that Israel will facilitate their purchase of the Sputnik vaccine from Russia. Well, hold on a second. Why would Israel need to facilitate Palestinians' purchase of a vaccine if Palestinians are responsible for their own health affairs? There's a bit of a contradiction there, don't you think? And of course, even that turned out to be a lie. When Gaza tried to import vaccines from Russia, Israel blocked it. A shipment of a mere 1,000 doses, which is barely enough for 500 people, was still blocked by Israel. This is so emblematic of their wicked treatment towards Palestinians. According to Al Jazeera, Israeli lawmakers were even debating whether to let in vaccines out of fear that they would go to Hamas leadership. Well, here's a solution. Why not just give all Palestinian civilians vaccines? Then you won't have to worry about that, right? So Israel even waited 3 months. Since December, they waited 3 months before giving vaccines to the 100,000 plus Palestinians that it uses as cheap labor who cross over into Israel every day. Here's a PR photo that they put out in some depraved attempt to make themselves look like humanitarian occupiers and whitewash their occupation. I mean, it's so dehumanizing. Israel still has millions of vaccines, while millions of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have none. And like with all criticisms of Zionism, Israel grew furious when people began calling out its racist medical apartheid towards Palestinians. The Guardian was accused of lying and asked to apologize over its articles. Even Michael Che, who joked on Saturday Night Live about Israel only vaccinating its Jewish population, was accused of racism. Netanyahu, along with Danny Dunan and several other Israeli officials, quickly rushed to accuse him of anti-Semitism. So while the Israelis have been able to enjoy an easing of lockdown restrictions and a drop in infections of COVID-19, just earlier this month, on March 11, Palestinians saw their worst day yet with a record 27 fatalities and 2,300 registered cases in a single day. And while Palestinians have been able to acquire some 2,000 doses from Israel, 10,000 doses of the Sputnik vaccine from Russia, and another 60,000 doses delivered by the United Nations through its COVAX program. This is nowhere near enough to inoculate a population of 5 million. Even since last year in May 2020, the United Nations asked Israel to have mercy on the hundreds of Palestinian children that it keeps in its jails and to release them for fear that they might catch COVID or spark an outbreak. Israel ignored this request and is still illegally detaining Palestinian children, just as we saw a few days ago in Hebron, continuing to brutalize them and doesn't even care to release them or inoculate them, putting their health at further risk. And in December of 2020, initially, Israel's public security minister, Amir Ohana, refused to allow Palestinian prisoners to be vaccinated in Israeli jails, and only for prison staff to be vaccinated. He even defied the orders of the health minister. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Asa Winstanley, investigative journalist and podcaster for Electronic Intifada. He writes extensively about Palestine. He's lived in Palestine. Thanks so much for taking the time, Asa. It's good to have you on.
Great to be with you, Richard. I've been a fan of your show, and you're doing really great work, so it's brilliant to be on.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So, Asa, I want to start out with the medical apartheid that's happening in occupied Palestine. You know, the Israelis are refusing to vaccinate Palestinians. What did you think of this idea that Israel wants to send vaccines to countries that will move their embassy to Jerusalem?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, Israel uses all tools that it can in the world, you know, to try and put pressure on countries to favor its international goals, you know. I mean, it uses all kinds of nefarious methods, so it's not completely surprising. But you're right, I mean, it's a typically despicable thing for them to do. And, you know, the thing that struck me as well was they started this program for vaccines for foreign diplomats living in Tel Aviv mostly, although, of course, the Americans have moved to Jerusalem now. And they're going to be vaccinating them, you know. But still, there's millions of Palestinians living in territories controlled by Israel that have not been vaccinated and have no entitlement to vaccines under Israeli apartheid.
So, I mean, how is the situation looking now? Because, you know, Israel says, oh, we're number one in vaccinations, but they're not counting the Palestinians that they're occupying. And now in March, Israel says they'll start vaccinating some of the Palestinian workers that cross over. So, I mean, is that it? Is that as far as it goes?
Under Israel's apartheid system, only the Jews, only the Israeli Jews have an entitlement to all sorts of different privileges, you know, and this is Israel's apartheid system. 6 million Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza Strip have no basic human or political rights under Israel's apartheid system. This is why it's called apartheid system, which, you know, there's literally different legal system for them. So this extends to the entitlement to vaccines as well. And it's only after Israel's come under massive amount of pressure and international criticism that they've even begun offering even a small token amount of Palestinians, the Palestinians who work in Israeli settlements, work in what's called Israel proper, beyond the green line, supposed, offering a limited amount of them some vaccines. And it's only, you know, because of this the description of it as vaccine apartheid, it's become a very sensitive issue for them. So they've offered these few vaccines, and now they're saying, well, it's not apartheid because, you know, we're offering some Palestinians the vaccine.
So, I mean, all these Israeli officials now, they're responding to this criticism by saying that it's anti-Semitic. And, you know, they even got mad at this SNL joke. I mean, what is that? Isn't that obscene, how they're calling out anyone who exposes their refusal to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention as anti-Semitic?
Yeah, I mean, this is the tactic. This is Israel's tactic, isn't it? It's always Israel's tactic is to distract from its crimes by accusing its critics of having some sort of ulterior motive. You know, and the Saturday Night Live incident was a good example of that. You know, there was this comedian, Michael Che, I think you say his name, who made this joke of that Israel is reporting that they vaccinated half of their population, and I'm going to guess that it's the Jewish half. Well, it was a joke. It was quite a funny joke. But it was basically true, you know, because Israel was offering only, as I said, like the Jewish half of the population was really the only people who were offered the vaccine. And what illustrates that more than ever is the fact that Israeli settlers in the West Bank, even, which even under international law, which, you know, the US and everyone, Britain claims to abide by but doesn't, even under that law, those settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law. Well, only Jews can live in them. And Israeli Jewish citizens living in those settlements, illegal settlements, were given and had right to the vaccine, but the Palestinians living in nearby communities were not. You know, so that's just a perfect example of it. And Israel's strategy is always to accuse its critics of anti-Semitism, and starting with the Palestinians.
So, I mean, Israel, they're saying that the Oslo Accords relieve them of their obligation to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Do you think it's true that a bilateral agreement can just cancel out a superseding international law, which is universal, essentially?
No, of course not. I mean, even the Oslo Accords themselves, which, you know, in my view, are illegitimate anyway, but even the Oslo Accords themselves state that Israel has an obligation to provide the Palestinian Authority with support during pandemics, you know. So it doesn't relieve Israel of its obligations under international law to provide basic services. Of course, in reality, the whole goal of the Oslo Accords was to essentially subcontract out Israeli occupation to, you know, an indigenous agent, essentially. You know, like all settler colonial powers, like all instances of imperialism, Israel relies on, tries to, and in certain circumstances has been, you know, has had some measures of success to recruit native agents for its power. You know, like the British, when they occupied India, would set different religious communities against each other in order to kind of to divide and rule and to increase their power. So the Israelis know that the Palestinian Authority can keep knows its population better than they could possibly, and it's kind of a mask for them. It's a way for them to kind of launder their image and get away from fulfilling its obligations under international law.
Yeah, and now some Arab countries as well. And, you know, I'm a bit curious because I know it's a rhetorical question, I think, but, you know, the ICC is probing Israel for war crimes, and now we have Israel violating the Geneva Convention yet again. Do you think that there are going to be any actual consequences for what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in regards to depriving them of vaccines? I know that's kind of a rhetorical question. I don't think anyone is going to actually do anything to them, but what do you think the long-term effects of this will be?
The ICC investigation is an interesting one because it's true, you know, that it's been very slow in happening. The chief prosecutor of the ICC has announced this and she's on her way out. So to clarify, she hasn't been sacked, but she's stepping down from her role, and just before she stepped down, I can't remember if it was just before or just after, but around about the same time she stepped down, she's finally, after years of talking about it and kind of prevaricating, said, okay, we are going to launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Now, it's interesting because I think the ICC... if you look at the record of the ICC, I mean, I'm not an expert on it, but I think we all know and we can all see that almost only the only people that the ICC has prosecuted so far are political leaders who are black Africans, essentially, who are accused of war crimes. And the war crimes of the West and of Israel have not been touched by it. So I think as an international body, these international bodies like the UN and the International Criminal Court and the World Court as well before it, as ostensibly international bodies, I think they do come under pressure to an extent from people in, you know, what used to be called the Third World, the Global South, and political leaders there who are starting to notice, hang on, you're only prosecuting black Africans. What's going on here? You know, what about Britain's crimes in Iraq? What about the US crimes in Afghanistan? You know, what about the European colonial crimes? You know, if we're going back in time, you know, all over the world. And in a way, in some ways, Israel is the last outpost of European colonialism that is still ongoing as a active settler colonial project. You know, the French were driven out of Algeria by an anti-colonial rebellion. You know, if you go back further, Haiti was the first state in the world to abolish slavery when the former enslaved Africans liberated themselves from the brutality of French slavery, and then they fought off, you know, they fought off three colonial powers: the British, the Spanish, and the French, to become free. So, like, Israel is a settler colonial project which is still ongoing in this way, which was launched by a Western European power under the auspices of the British Empire. So I suppose in a way the ICC agreeing to prosecute that, it could be the start of something, which is why it has been viewed as dangerous by the British government and the US government, with the US government even sanctioning the chief prosecutor of the ICC, you know, at Israel's behest, at Israel's request. And that was done under the Trump administration. The same sanctions are under place, you know, even though Biden's the great white hope. Yeah, they're still in place. So these vindictive Trump sanctions are still being enforced by the Biden administration. So it depends. Let's see what happens. There are some very good Palestinian lawyers who have been working for many years now to try and use these institutions to get what they're ostensibly designed to do, right? Which is achieve justice for people who have been subjected to these crimes.
I want to remind you very briefly of Israel's recent history and how it treats healthcare workers, doctors, and what it does to Palestinian health infrastructure, right? Do you remember during 2009, during Operation Castlet, Israel purposely deprived Palestinians of food, of medical supplies, of essential care, and deliberately blocked and otherwise impeded emergency relief and humanitarian assistance, and purposely targeted vehicles that were carrying humanitarian relief, and violated international law. In 2014, during Israel's ground invasion of Gaza, Israel killed over 2,200 Palestinians. 65% of them were civilians. The UN found that, quote, 17 hospitals, 56 primary healthcare facilities, and 45 ambulances were damaged or destroyed. The total cost to Gaza's healthcare system, $50 million. 16 healthcare workers were killed, and 83, most of them ambulance drivers and volunteers, were injured. Then also in 2018, 2019, during the Right to Return marches, Israel purposely shot at and targeted unarmed Palestinians, wounding thousands of them and killing over 180. Among them, medical staff. A report by the United Nations found that Israeli snipers intentionally shot healthcare workers despite seeing that they were clearly marked as such. One of those healthcare workers was 20-year-old Ruzan El-Najjar, who worked tirelessly as a medic to help the injured and tend to the wounded. Her death caused widespread outrage, and the Israeli occupation forces even tried to smear her after one of their own snipers deliberately killed her. Gaza itself, which has been devastated by Israel's ruthless bombings over and over, has been under siege from Israel and Egypt since 2007, with only limited humanitarian supplies being allowed through. Even construction materials are not permitted. Israel literally picks and chooses what Palestinians in Gaza can bring into their own country. A UN report from 2009 states that the Israeli blockade is one of the main reasons there is not enough medical equipment or medical supplies available. All this to say that Israel is no problem killing medical workers and medics and doctors and destroying medical and public health infrastructure belonging to Palestinians. So of course, when it suits Israel, Israel claims that Palestinians are autonomous and that they can deal with their own health issues. And yet when something doesn't suit them, like the International Criminal Court saying it will investigate them for war crimes, then all of a sudden, Israel claims that this is not possible, that Palestine is not a real state, and the ICC can't expand jurisdiction there. Sheer hypocrisy. This is what occupation looks like. This is Israel's true face, not the one that they sell you in the mainstream media about how Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. That's a fairy tale slogan. Israel is not a democracy. Israel is a racist, colonialist settler project that was created by the United Kingdom. Israel treats Palestinians like they are less than human. Israel, since its foundation, has been ethnically cleansing the Palestinian people, bulldozing their homes, turning them into refugees, killing them in cold blood. Israel is one of the biggest human rights violators on the face of this planet. It has no respect for the Geneva Convention, nor for international law. Israel has purposely targeted public health infrastructure, purposely targeted medical workers, purposely targeted nurses, doctors, and paramedics, and this is documented by virtually every single news outlet and human rights organization that exists. So it's absolutely no surprise that an apartheid, genocidal regime like that would now deprive Palestinians of a vaccine even during a global pandemic on their own land and then try to whitewash its racist apartheid crimes and boast about how successful it is. This is just another chapter in Israel's long and brutal oppression of the Palestinian people, its cruel and inhumane treatment of them during war and during occupation. This depraved, wicked treatment of Palestinians will go down in history as one of the worst crimes against humanity. And people will scratch their heads. How the entire world, including many Arab nations, stood by watching and did nothing. It's an absolute disgrace, and anyone with a conscience can see that. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, remember, the best out of these pieces of advice of mine are those which tell you to fear Allah, to concentrate and to confine yourself to the performance of those duties which have been made incumbent upon you by Him, and to follow in the footsteps of your ancestors, the Holy Prophet and Imam Ali, and your pious and virtuous relationship. Verily, they always carefully measured their thoughts and deeds, as you must also try to do, and they carefully thought over the subject before saying anything about it or before doing the deed. You should also follow the same. This kind of deliberation made them take from life what was really the best and forsake that which was not made incumbent upon them or which was not the best. If your mind refuses to accept my advice and you persist to try your own experiments like them, then you are at liberty to arrive at your conclusions, but only after thoroughly studying the subject and after acquiring the knowledge necessary for such decisions.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the great things which we learn from Imam Ali's universal persona is the fact that when it comes to charity, we should give as much as we can. Now, there was a point in time in Imam Ali's life where his property was 4 dirhams on the whole. And what is very beautiful about it is that Imam Ali alayhi salam gave all 4 dirhams which he had, which was all that he had given all of it away as charity, one at night, one by day, the third secretly, and the fourth he gave openly. And so in response to this divine act of Imam Ali, Allah the Almighty revealed the following verse in the Holy Quran. As for those who spend their property by day and by night, secretly and openly, they have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve. This verse is verse number 274 in chapter number 2, chapter Al-Baqarah. Now, this is very beautiful that there are verses of the Holy Quran which refer directly to Imam Ali alayhi salam. And on the same occasion, like some of the other verses, this verse did not apply to anyone except Imam Ali. And so the revelation of this verse about Imam Ali is one of his special merits. And most of the commentators of the Holy Quran believe that this verse was revealed in relation to Imam Ali. And the beauty of it, dear friends, the great lesson is that there are times where we might not want to give charity, but we should and we must give charity. And now nobody is saying that we should give away all of our property in charity, because of course, you know, we need to have means and livelihood to continue our own lives. But if our religious leaders and our divinely appointed imams could give away all of their property, then surely we can give away some. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
You for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. Ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger." For protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. For protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi,
Let me just talk about the purpose according to Quran when it comes to the issue of fasting. That basically when we go through this process of fasting for 29 or 30 days, it has less to do with the physical fitness or losing a few pounds at the end of the month. And it has everything to do with the issue of spiritual fitness. If you look at the ayat of Quran in Surah Baqarah, ayat number 183 to ayat number 187, this is the passage where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed the order as well as the rules about the basic rulings about fasting. It's very interesting to look at the first and the last ayat in that passage. The very first ayat basically is a command. Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu kutiba alaykum as-siyam kama kutiba alal ladhina min qablikum la'allakum tattaqun. That this first ayat ends with these two words, la'allakum tattaqun. Where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, hopefully you will acquire taqwa. You know, awareness of Allah's, you know, conscience of Allah's presence in our life all the time. The last ayat, you know, ends by saying that tilka hududullah fala taqrabuha. The rules, you know, mentioned about fasting, these are the limits that Allah has put there. And do not violate them. كَذَلِكَ يُبَيِّنُ اللَّهُ آيَاتِهِ لِلنَّاسِ. This is how Allah explains His rulings to the people. And the passage now ends, the whole section, لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَّقُونَ. The first one ends with the words, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. The last one ends with the words, لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَّقُونَ. And this is where we see the emphasis is there in the beginning and the end, that the ultimate goal of fasting should be that we acquire taqwa.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Infighting within the Republican Party is set to come to a head this week, goaded on by the ghostly figure of former President Donald Trump in his Mar-a-Lago hideout in Florida. House Republicans are gearing up to oust Liz Cheney on Wednesday, 12th of May, from her position as the party's number three leader in the chamber. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled, Republicans Gear Up to Oust Liz Cheney as Punishment for Criticizing Trump. Infighting within the Republican Party is set to come to a head this week, goaded on by the ghostly figure of former President Donald Trump in his Mar-a-Lago hideout in Florida. House Republicans are gearing up to oust Liz Cheney on Wednesday, 12th of May, from her position as the party's number three leader in the chamber. Liz Cheney's removal will come as a punishment for her public criticism of Donald Trump with regard to his role in inciting the 6th of January Capitol insurrection and his big lie that last year's presidential election was stolen from him. Liz Cheney was one of 10 Republicans to vote in favor of impeaching Donald Trump for incitement of insurrection. Leading Republicans took to the political talk show circuit on Sunday, 9th of May, to express support or opposition to the congresswoman from Wyoming. Critically, Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, who has in the past stood up for Liz Cheney, made their breakup official when he told Fox News Channel that he was endorsing Cheney's rival, Elise Stefanik, for the number three post in the House of Representatives. What we're talking about is a position in leadership. As conference chair, you have one of the most critical jobs as a messenger going forward, Kevin McCarthy told Maria Bartiromo on Sunday, 9th of May. Jim Banks, an Indiana congressman who chairs the largest Republican caucus in the House of Representatives, attempted to justify the action against Liz Cheney on grounds of party discipline. Republicans are almost completely unified by a single mission to oppose the radical, dangerous Joe Biden agenda. Any other leader who is not focused on that needs to be replaced, Jim Banks said. Pressed by television journalist Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday, Jim Banks was unable to hold up appearances for long. Asked whether he still questioned whether Joe Biden won the presidential election fair and square, Jim Banks said that he stood by his decision on 6th of January to object to certifying the Electoral College votes in several states. I have serious concerns about how the election was conducted. That's why I objected on 6th of January. And I'll never apologize for that, he said. Elise Stefanik, a representative from New York who is now the front-runner to take over from Liz Cheney, has a paradoxically much more moderate voting record than the woman she would replace. Significantly, Elise Stefanik has been preferred because she has gone along with Donald Trump's lies about the stolen election, despite officials calling it the most secure election in U.S. history. As Liz Cheney's fate comes to a head, the fallout from Donald Trump's false claim that the vote count was rigged against him continues to destabilize the Republican Party. Several states, including Texas, Georgia, and Florida, have moved aggressively to restrict access to the ballot box in ways that will especially impact communities of color, under the same discredited theory of voter integrity. In Arizona, Republican Party leaders have brought in an audit firm called Cyber Ninjas, which has no expertise in election monitoring, to examine how the presidential vote was conducted in Maricopa County. Part of the exercise involves checking to see whether 40,000 ballots cast for Joe Biden contain traces of bamboo, according to a conspiracy theory that would indicate they were smuggled in from Asia. As Donald Trump's enduring grip over his supporters roils the party, rare individuals still publicly defend Liz Cheney. Bill Cassidy, a U.S. senator from Louisiana, told NBC News' Meet the Press that there's a whole group of folks that agree with Liz Cheney. For us to win in 2022 and 2024, we need everybody. We need those who feel as Liz Cheney does.
IRIB English Radio presents The Month of Allah. Let's be with Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
As I look to nature's beauty, dazzled am I, knowing everything calls on you, the Lord Most High.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to the program Month of Allah. As the month of Ramadan is winding down, this is a very sad time for the believers. Because if we were to understand how great the month of Ramadan truly was, we wish it would last the entire month. Because we are the guests of Allah, because this is His month. Therefore, when the month of Ramadan comes to an end, some people are worrying about what are they going to do afterwards, what's going to happen to their spirituality afterwards. To address this question, there is positive news that now that we have purified ourselves, we have done repentance, we have sought the forgiveness of God, we have done many different acts of worship, we are now in a better position to continue our spiritual journey after the month of Ramadan. That we should not make the month of Shawwal a month that we are now relaxed. A month that if I followed and obeyed the commands of God during the month of Ramadan, that now I can be much more relaxed in the month of Shawwal. That should not be true. Because when a person acts and performs amal as-salih, good actions, genuine actions, that itself is a nur, that itself is a light, and that's going to guide them spiritually towards a higher level. Therefore, now that we have all these great actions, because the night of Qadr, the actions are worth more than 80 years of worship. Now that we have put these actions behind us, and now that we have performed these actions, we have light, we have nur, and that we have a better chance to increase our spirituality after the month of Ramadan. When we look at one of the traditions from Imam Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth Imam, he has narrated to us, said, "Udu anfusakum al khair." Get yourself accustomed to khair. In the holy month of Ramadan, how much have we gotten accustomed to reciting the Holy Quran? It's much easier for us now. So when you're accustomed to something, it's much easier for you to go on the same track and continue reading the Holy Quran and make it part of your daily routine. When we think about our prayers that we did, when we think about that connection that we had, when we think about fasting, even recommended fasting, it's much easier for us to continue the same track that we had, because this is how spirituality works. When you get accustomed to something, it's much easier for you for it to occur, and you don't even think about it anymore. Those that have performed mustahabat and recommended deeds, and they have gotten themselves used to it, it is becomes for them very natural, and they don't even think about doing those mustahab things. For example, having wudu when you go outside, having wudu and having ablution, and you're always cleansed and pure, it becomes something second nature for us. So this is the good, glad tidings that we have, that after the month of Ramadan ends, we have a new light, we have more nur, and we are more accustomed to doing good. We're accustomed to going to the masjid. Let's not break this habit. Some of these habits that we have now are good habits. And the other narration, it says, "Man ya'mal yazdad quwwatan," from Imam Ali alayhi salam. When a person acts, he becomes stronger. We are now much more stronger. The way that we can fight against our nafs, we can fight against our lower desires, we are much more stronger. We had taken away water and drink and food from ourselves. Therefore, we are the most powerful people when it comes to fighting our nafs and our lower desires. We are stronger. And if a person, man yugassir fil amal yazdad fatra, if a person has shortcomings in his actions, he becomes weaker. So after the month of Ramadan, this is when a believer should shine the most. This is when a believer continues. Because the stages of spirituality happen slowly, and slowly you increase your connection to God and you reach a higher level. Let's not go back down and think that the month of Ramadan is and has ended, therefore I'm going to be and go back to the same person I used to be. You are now a new person. Let's continue and strive and progress in the path of spirituality after the month of Ramadan.
قال الإمام الحسن عليه السلام: التفكر حياة قلب البصير.
Imam Hassan alayhi salam said, thinking is the life of the heart of the cognizant.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, ma lana rabbun siwa. La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, ma lana rabbun siwa.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.